Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke and Department of Emergency Management Director Willie Bentz will now brief our commissioners and you, our KPTZ listeners.
To my parents, or to my family constantly, is a requested song from public health as part of our campaign against vaccine hesitancy. So I will share my screen. And Carolyn and I tested this once, so it should work, no problem.
And is this streaming on KPTZ too?
Oh yeah, so we're on KPTZ. Well, so we'll subject the radio world to it too, but I did add subtitles so you can understand what I'm actually saying. Can you see that?
Yep.
Volume's quiet, Greg.
Well, it's Pfizer, Moderna. Hold on 1 second. There's a setting I need to do. I'm going to start it again. Where is it? It's the volume. Sorry, I need to turn on my volume. I learned that and forgot how to do it.
Okay, and I didn't know your daughter played bass.
She does.
Cool. Yeah.
And just to tell you, this is to the tune of Wildwood Flower. She's actually enjoying it, but she's also 12, so she has to look like she's not enjoying everything at the same time. But I showed her this one time, and she learned the song and got one little bit wrong. And I was like, oh, that's not quite right. And she's like, it sounds fine. So this is her basically just learning it that day. Well, there's Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson. They are strong vaccines with emergency sanction. Research continued, though funding was too low. Messenger RNA, it was ready for the show. Well, I'll dance and I will sing and my laughter shall be gay when my time comes in line, probably not till May. There are some who will tell you, don't be too quick, that the bleeding edge can leave more than a nick. But the quicker we get to herd immunity, the faster we can have live community. So let's all buckle down and listen to the facts. Society is stronger if we all get the vax. Well, side effects do exist, but the facts are quite clear. To date, the downsides to the value is not near. Maybe you'll feel lousy for a day or two, but just ask those still sick, which would you choose? This is our shot to end COVID-19 for your friends and your family. Please take the vaccine. We have shown our true spirit in this difficult year. When we all get our shots, then the end will be here. When we all get our shots, then the end will be here.
Yay! Thank you, Commissioner Bretherton.
Yes, thanks for indulging me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Dr. Locke, that's a tough act to follow.
Indeed.
All yours.
Indeed, but maybe we can pick up the challenge, and I have something from public health. I'll have to round up those with musical talent. Great song, great performance, and great message too, vaccine increasing and addressing vaccine hesitancy is really becoming an increasing focus of ours. Well, good morning, and just starting with the epidemiology, cases continue to rise in the U.S. Not quite as fast, but at 11% increase. Over the last week, still mainly focused in the upper Midwest and the East Coast states, New York and New Jersey especially. And the number of new cases per week in the US is steadily climbing. So it's at around 69,000 a day. And this is higher than the peak of last summer and comparable to where we were in November of this last year. So we really never got back down to the point that we were before last summer's rise. Here in Washington, our increase has been greater. So we're up 23% over the last 2 weeks. Hospitalization is up even more, increased 32%. And now what we're seeing is not people in their 70s and 80s, but people in their 40s and 50s are really who's driving hospitalization rates. Fortunately, the risk of death is much lower in those age groups. So we're continuing to see our death rate decline in this state. It's down by 27%. And that's really a testament to the protective ability of the vaccines and the fact that we've now substantially vaccinated our populations over 65 in this state, and they're being protected from the most severe manifestations of the virus. In Jefferson County, we had 10 cases over the last week and then 7 cases the week before. So that brings our 2 week total to 17, and that's a case rate of 53.29 per 100,000. So that's over double what it was in the prior 2 week reporting period. And our positivity of cases, of tests, I should say, has remained relatively low at around 1%. But our testing rate has dropped relative to the state averages and our neighboring counties. So that's going to be something we need to really reinforce, is that people should be tested whenever they have symptoms. We certainly have anyone who's been exposed to a known case get tested 7 days after their exposure. And there also are recommendations that if you come back to the state, you know, after high-risk travel, that it's important to be tested 3 to 5 days after your return. Clallam County's case rates have been going up even faster than Jefferson County. They're now at 87 cases per 100,000, and 5.4% of tests are positive. And Kitsap's even higher at 144 cases per 100,000. And 6.1% positivity. And as we had long predicted, variants are driving these trends. Currently, it's actually two California variants, what's known as the B1427 and the B1429 strains are accounting for over 50% of cases in Washington state. These are variants that arose in California and are more contagious than the prior circulating strain. What we call the shorthand name for the prior strain is called the G strain. And the more concerning UK strain, the B117 strain, is gaining ground. It's currently at about 34% of cases, and we expect that percentage to double about every 12 days now. So by the middle of the month, which we're quite close to at this point, we expect that around 50% of cases will be the UK variant. And something we're watching very closely is the Brazilian variant, the so-called P1 variant, which is still relatively rare in Washington state, but is causing outbreaks in British Columbia. Whistler had a large outbreak, Vancouver has had an outbreak, and although there's not a lot of travel back and forth between British Columbia and Washington state these days, there is a risk. There isn't much recreational travel, but there's a lot of commercial travel back and forth between the province and the state. And so we're watching P1 very carefully because it causes more severe disease. And we think the vaccines are less effective against P1, although they still are effective. Today is a significant day in the roadmap to recovery plan because this is the day when the rates are recalculated, or actually the three-week rates are recalculated as of Friday of last week. And at least in the original plan, it was the metrics that were to apply is, you know, if you had more than 200 cases per 100,000 over 2 weeks, or if your hospitalization rate exceeded 5 cases per 100,000, that would cause you to move back from phase 3 to phase 2. And then a different system was used for counties like Jefferson, who have a population under 50,000, where originally it was 30 cases over 2 weeks, but then it got increased to 100 cases and 3 hospitalizations. Originally the metrics were if as a county you exceeded either of those measures, you would need to step back a phase. But we believe the governor is going to apply a new criteria where you have to exceed most metric or both metrics. And so a number of counties that would have been required to step back may not be required to do so. We're not really going to know exactly which counties are affected until we have the governor's announcement. But a number of large counties like Pierce and Yakima, as well as some smaller counties like Cowlitz and Kittitas are definitely over those levels. And really all counties are increasing around the state. We find that the roadmap to recovery metrics are problematic for small counties. Our threshold is actually very high relative to others. 100 cases in Jefferson County would translate into a case rate of 312 cases per 100,000, which is way above not only where we've ever been before, but also way above our ability to keep up with that kind of outbreak activity. We think that at about 100 cases per 100,000 is where we start to lose control through our traditional methods of case investigation and contact tracing and isolation and quarantine. We've been able to do that extremely well in Jefferson County, do very intensive case investigation on every case, check in with them daily, make sure everyone's in quarantine. And we've ended up detecting a lot of positive cases in quarantined individuals. But what happens when your rates get above a certain level is you can no longer keep up with it. And so you turn the case reporting, case investigation over to the state, to a phone bank, which calls people and lets them know they're infected and gathers information, tells them they ought to isolate, and they also ought to tell their contacts that they've been exposed, and that's it. That's the kind of the control mechanism. And as you might imagine, it doesn't work that well. And so cases tend to rise. So we're really at a critical junction in the state right now, and the health officers, we met several times on Friday. A subgroup of us has been working over the weekend to a letter to the governor, letting them know that it's we don't want to become the next Michigan. This is a real critical time to control transmission, especially in some of these indoor activities that are allowed under phase 3. We're concerned that the phase system has given people the impression that certain indoor activities, high density dining and sports events and large gatherings are somehow safe, and they're not. And they're especially unsafe for the unvaccinated. Maintaining those kind of indoor activities at a time when prevalence is going up and up is to invite even higher rates. Each health officer, county by county, has the authority to do what the governor has done statewide. We've not really wanted to do it that way, but that may be how it plays out. If we really don't have a state program to control infection, then we have to look at trying to do it regionally or even county by county. So this will be one of the difficult issues we'll be grappling with this week. We're looking to say, I think I've mostly covered this part. We think we're about two months away from the vaccination levels in this state that would really prevent transmission at phase three and above kind of levels. We're really making great strides in that statewide. We've administered over 4 million doses to Washington State residents, and the logistics of this is daunting because we do this one shot at a time, and at that level, at 4 million doses, we've managed to vaccinate about a third of, or at least give a first dose to 33% of Washingtonians, and fully vaccinate 21%. In Jefferson County, we've gone beyond those metrics, and we're actually the highest in the state at 51.6% of Jefferson County residents have had their first dose, and 36.7% are fully vaccinated. And those are percentages actually of our total county population. So 11.8% of Jefferson County is under age 18, and by and large is not eligible for the vaccine. So the percentage of people over 18 is even higher than those numbers. And Clallam County is a very close second place statewide. So the Olympic Peninsula has the highest vaccination rates and the lowest COVID rates in the state. But we feel it's really important to keep it that way until we get to the finish line sometime in June, where everyone in the state who are in the county and the state who wants to be vaccinated has had an opportunity to do that. Right now, what's holding us back is vaccine supply itself. We are only receiving about a third of the vaccine that we are capable of administering at this point. We're getting 700 doses of vaccine into Jefferson County this week, 600 doses of Moderna, 100 doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, or at least getting those from the state. And we'll split that vaccine between the hospital drive-through clinic and the Chimicum High School clinic event that we're going to have next Saturday. And then Don's Pharmacy is going to join the ranks of pharmacies doing vaccinations. They're going to get 100 doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And then the Jamestown Tribe, which received a large allocation of Johnson & Johnson vaccine, has generously agreed to share it. Some of it with Jefferson County. So they will be transferring 500 doses of this one and done vaccine to Jefferson Healthcare this week. And they'll be adding that to their drive-through clinic. And then the Jamestown Clallam Tribe plans some large one and done events in Clallam County. There'll be one in Port Angeles on the 18th. And then the Cary Blake drive-through park will be reopened on April 20th and 22nd. And for anyone 18 years of age and older, there will be no restrictions on vaccine eligibility as of Thursday of this week. And the Actually, Jefferson County residents have always been welcome in the SQIM drive-through, but now they're officially so. So we're really looking at this as a North Olympic activity, and we're partnering on a number of fronts and trying to get both counties over the finish line and get at least 70% of our residents vaccinated, and the higher the better in terms of that statistic. So we'll be limited by vaccine supply. The forecasts for what we're going to receive for the remainder of this month are relatively flat. We're not anticipating an increase, at least from the state. And the report from Johnson & Johnson last week was not good news. We learned that their allocations to the states, at least in the short run, are going to be decreased by 86%. And for Washington State, that meant that last week we received 109,000 doses of that vaccine. And this week we're only going to get about 13,000 doses. And that's going to stay until they, the factory that managed to ruin 15 million doses of the vaccine, they have 65 million doses already manufactured and ready to ship, but they can't ship them until their factory is certified as being compliant with the quality standards. And so we don't really know when that's going to happen, but until it does, the amount of Johnson & Johnson vaccine we were counting on is not going to be available. And we've really been focusing on that vaccine for our pop-up events, such as the one that occurred in Quilacing this last weekend. And also from polling, we know that this is really the vaccine of choice for the 20 and 30 and 40-year-olds who are now becoming newly eligible. They really like the idea of one vaccination and then being done with it. So we're trying to address that need. And then in terms of KPTZ questions this week, there are none. This is the first week that I doubt that all questions have been answered successfully, but we at least, there were no questions from listeners. So in terms of the Quilacing event this week, I'll leave Willie to report on that because I asked them on Friday if they needed me to be present, and the answer was no. They had it covered. So, and I think that's a real testament to how our volunteers are becoming increasingly comfortable with these events. And that's our plan, is to, in addition to the large high school events, to do as many of these pop-up events around the county. So in Brennan and Hadlock and Port Ludlow and you know, anywhere we have a group of people who wants to get together, and you know, we can do 100-150 doses in about a 3-hour period, and many of these we'll do in partnerships with local pharmacies, but you know, we have the capability of doing them on our own as well. And so what we're really preparing for is what we're expecting in May, when the spigots should really open up on vaccine availability. And we want to go kind of in as hard and fast as we can to get to the finish line and be administering not hundreds of doses a week, but thousands of doses. Because by my calculation, we have somewhere between 8 and 10,000 people in Jefferson County who have yet to initiate a vaccine series. And that's assuming that somewhere between 70 and 80% of people will actually consent to vaccination. We've never believed that number would be 100%. But if we get it above 70%, we think we'll be at a reasonable herd immunity level, and 80% would be even better. That's really our target, is to try to get to 80%. But we don't yet know if that's achievable. There is significant vaccine hesitancy, but hopefully after today's musical presentation, that's been diminished a bit. So we'll keep measuring it and see what the impact is. So with that, I'll open it to questions.
Great, I have a couple for you, Dr. Locke, and I'll just start by saying it's I have two friends who do not live locally, but very conscientious, cautious families that have been doing everything the same way all year. You know, we've all learned a lot over the last year about how to avoid infection. And two families I know, you know, had positive COVID cases. And I think that speaks to that increased contagiousness of the variants. And it's just really scary to think of, you know, people doing what we've all gotten good at doing, and that wasn't enough for either of those families. So that is a new caution to me. One, I'm wondering, I've heard, and I'm not sure if you can speak to this, if you or Willie have details on this, I've heard that Jefferson Healthcare is going to do a clinic specifically for the 16 to 18 year olds. They got some Pfizer. Can you speak to that?
Yes, there are two clinics scheduled so far that I'm aware of. And first targeting 16 and 17 year olds with chronic medical conditions, who are now among the eligible group. But as of Thursday of this week, it's anyone 16 or older is eligible for the Pfizer vaccine, and 18 years and older for any of the vaccines. Challenge with this is we're not getting Pfizer vaccine into the county any longer. The minimum shipping amount for that vaccine is 11,700 doses, and that's above our allocation. But the reason we still have Pfizer vaccine is you can get more of the vaccine out of the vials than was originally projected. And so the hospital's been able to stockpile some Pfizer vaccine and build up a small reserve. And they did it with the plan of vaccinating the 16 and 17 year olds, because that's the only vaccine that they can take. We think that's gonna change pretty soon. Maybe as early as May, probably into June, is that both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine will be licensed for younger populations. Pfizer's on the verge of submitting their request to have their vaccine licensed for 12 and older, and Moderna's likely going to do this very soon as well. And we have strong evidence to believe that these vaccines are both safe and effective in these age groups. So, but for right now, we're bound by the licensure of the vaccine, and we want to the hospital is going to prioritize Pfizer for these younger populations, and then use Moderna and Johnson & Johnson for the 18 and olders.
That's great. I'm so pleased that they've put some aside for this age group, because isn't it true nationally that we're seeing the, you know, average age of cases go down and down? It's the younger populations that are contracting.
Yeah, that's exactly it, and that's concerning to us, that we're seeing more disease in teenagers and children, and as you pointed out, that people who previously were being careful and were uninfected are now becoming infected because there are variants out there that are considerably more transmissible than what was there before.
Mm-hmm. And just one more question. I seem to always preface them with a comment, though. I did want to announce that the governor's press conference is at 2:30 today for anyone who's actively following the roadmap to recovery. It surprises me, given what we hear about our trajectory right now, that the governor is kind of backing off from rolling back to phase two, or at least that's my interpretation of it. Is that worrisome to you, that he's raising the bar for staying at phase three, or maybe that's lowering the bar, depending how you look at it? You know, it just seems really strange that the way we're headed, that we're not going to be rolling back those counties to more mitigation.
Yeah, it's very concerning, because you know you only really get one chance to react. If you wait until you're absolutely forced to react, it's too late, because it's much harder to bring a high case rate down than to prevent it from becoming high in the first place. So that's the dilemma, and we appreciate how incredibly difficult it is balancing all the economic and psychological and political issues, and we never miss an opportunity to applaud Governor Inslee for what a great job he's done up to this point. And Washington State has one of the best records in the country, but as health officers, our message is to stay the course. Is we've got about 2 months to go, and COVID-19 is not a benign illness. You know, even if it doesn't make you sick enough to be hospitalized, we have some really concerning data about the long haulers, and the fact that somewhere between 10 and 30% of people that get COVID-19, even mild cases of it, are still having symptoms 6 months or later after their infection. And in some cases, maybe facing lifelong disability from the effects of the disease. So this is not like flu. It's a very different disease. It's a disease that causes vascular complications, and preventing every case is both a short-term and long-term priority.
Thank you. Heidi, Greg, Philip, any questions? Go ahead, Heidi.
I just wanted to say that what you said last week about hesitancy worked. Someone very close to me in my life went and got her vaccine. And I brought it up at the staff. So we had our senior team meeting last week, and Vicky was talking about how, you know, hesitancy is a real thing, and that it's really comes down to people listening to the people closest to them in their lives. And I think it's important for everyone who is not totally anti-vax to help with that kind of outreach, and reach out to people who you know and care about, who may be waiting because they think other people need to get in line before them, waiting because they might be afraid of the vaccine, for whatever reason, the hesitancy is there. I think it's super important that we take care of our people. So thank you, Dr. Locke, and thanks for getting the word out about hesitancy. It's really important. That's it from me.
Greg?
Yeah, you know, I'm curious, Dr. Locke, if you have a prediction about how the governor's press conference is gonna go. I see that Skagit County Commissioners is one of the guests, and curious to see if you have any insight there, or not an insight, a guess.
Originally the criteria were if you exceeded either of those thresholds, you would have to step back. We think it's likely that it's going to become both thresholds have to be exceeded, and that would significantly limit the number of states. But there still are counties that exceed both thresholds, and there will be more in the not too distant future. Because if not for the variants, we would be much more comfortable with the roadmap plan. The roadmap plan was really conceived of, and the metrics were generated for a prior version of coronavirus that was not near as contagious. And now we're dealing with a different problem, and we have to take that into account.
And I guess my other question is about vaccine hesitancy and the nexus with political ideology and, you know, anti-masking behavior too. And I'm just wondering if you have any insight into how we can, you know, separate these. There's few things that frustrate me more than people that saying masks don't work and the vaccine doesn't work either. I'm like, come on, what do you want us to do? So is there a way that we can message this to separate them, I guess?
It's something we've worked on for a long time with you know, vaccine hesitancy, even before COVID-19. And there are a group, they're known as the unpersuadables, whose beliefs are just woven into a worldview that is not really changeable. We know that, you know, asking them to change their beliefs about vaccination really means changing a whole collection of beliefs they have, and it just doesn't happen. But we think that number is really pretty low. It's maybe 5%, 10% at the most are true unpersuadables. And then the rest are somewhere in between, are amenable to not only science-based facts, but the advice of trusted medical advisors and family members and friends, that counts for a lot. In fact, that may be a lot, that may be more decisive than the fact-based information we get out is that what friends and family tell you. And so we really urge people to talk about it and talk through the issues. I think that might be one of our most effective strategies.
Great, thanks. That's it for me, except quick comment. You know, there were no questions in KPTZ, but another real compliment about the service that we're in the middle of right now. And I think it's been a big part of our success is real open communication about what's going on, what it means. So thanks again.
And I might mention, we recorded, there's a KPTZ show. I think I'm probably getting the title wrong, but Richard Ambrose and his co-host, and so they recorded a interview with me last night, or the late afternoon, I should say, on Sunday, and I believe that's going to be broadcast this week. So there, if you can't get enough of this stuff, there's more coming this week.
Go ahead, Philip.
I have a question, Dr. Locke, and that is for people who do get vaccinated, are there any statistics on what impact that has on long hauler syndrome? In other words, people who get vaccinated, number one, fewer of those get sick at all, but a small percentage still may get more mild symptoms. For those who do get sick and have been vaccinated, does that reduce at all long haulers syndrome?
We don't know yet. We actually do have some preliminary reports that people with long haulers syndrome who get vaccinated have some improvement in the syndrome. We hope that turns out to be true. We don't know it for sure. We do recommend that if people who have had COVID-19 still get vaccinated, because it gives you a better protection against infection than natural infection does, is what our research indicates. But yeah, that question of what the impact of vaccination on long hauler syndrome, we don't know yet. At least for those who get the infection, who have so-called breakthrough infections, and it does occur as we expected. So far, it appears pretty rare, but it is still possible to get infection even if you're fully vaccinated.
Right, but I think even for those who do get sick, if we don't have the statistics yet on incidence of long hauler syndrome, the fact that you cut down the number of people who get sick at all very significantly means that you're also cutting down very significantly the amount of long hauler syndrome.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's always preventing something is always better than having to deal with the consequences of having it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's important, again, for the public to understand is, you know, this disease we're finding beyond the hospitalizations and beyond the risk of death, that there is this risk of long haulers syndrome, which can create a number of both health and psychological impacts. I guess anxiety, depression are significant aspects of that. And I think just sort of mental fogginess, if I understand correctly.
Yes, and especially concerned, you know, impaired cardiovascular status. So you know, shortness of breath, exercise intolerance, things that physically prevent people from being able to work.
Uh-huh. So, you know, that stuff is serious, even if you're not, and that can happen even with a relatively mild case that doesn't require hospitalization. You can still get what you were just describing. And I think people should recognize that. And again, that's the value, again, for younger people too, of getting vaccinated, is to avoid that risk of long haulers, significantly reducing long haulers' risk.
Dean.
All right, anything else for Dr. Locke? Okay, thank you, Dr. Locke, and welcome, Willie Bentz. How are things at Emergency Management? We can't hear you, Willie. It's like you're muted. Can you hear us?
All right, can you hear me now?
Yep, welcome.
Oh, perfect, apologies for that. Thank you, Commissioner. Right off the top, Dr. Locke alluded to our pop-up clinic in Quilcene this past weekend, where we were able to deliver 123 doses of just a single dose Johnson & Johnson. That was done in partnership with Tri-Area Pharmacy, who provided the vaccine and did all the vaccine handling and really helped lead that clinic. So a huge thank you to Mark and his team over there. And then basically we augmented their operation with some of our DEM volunteers and basically use the same model we use at our larger Chimicum clinic in just a much kind of smaller capacity. So overall a success, again, 123 doses delivered. And again, as Dr. Locke alluded to, we'll be targeting a few other communities. We wanna hit our friends a little bit farther in the south in Brennan. We wanna do one for specifically Spanish speaking individuals, as well as a few other communities. So expect an announcement about some additional pop-ups here in the next couple of weeks. In the meantime, we are focused on our next large vaccine clinic at the multi-purpose room at the Chimicum School District. We're doing second doses in the morning, so we'll be following up with 330 individuals who got their first dose about a month ago. And then we have another 300 doses we're hoping to deliver in the afternoon. As of this time, we still do have 19 slots available for that first dose clinic in the afternoon. And they're all between the time of 3:20 p.m. and 3:50 p.m. So 19 doses still available. If you want to snag one of those appointments, which and anyone who's sitting on the fence and might be a little bit hesitant, I hope some of what you heard today will help convince you to go and grab one of those appointments. And you can do so through the public health webpage or by calling our EOC call center, 344-9791. So I'm really hoping we get those 19 slots filled up by Saturday. I'm pretty optimistic that we will. Other than that, no other additional updates from me. Again, no KPTZ questions. So I'm happy to answer anything from Philip or the commissioners.
Thank you, Willie. Anyone have a question for Willie?
Just a comment. I'll see you Saturday. I signed up for mine. Looking forward to it.
Beautiful. We'll be sure to roll out the red carpet for you.
Good. Willie, how many volunteers at this point are working on the clinic, and what's the status of recruiting and training volunteers?
So right now, our overall volunteer pool is well over about 250 individuals. And that includes both our clinical volunteers to actually deliver the shot or help monitor, et cetera. And then some of our more general administrative volunteers, traffic control folks, et cetera. We're still recruiting folks. Again, we're concerned, you know, long term, this is exhausting work. We're wanting to do more clinics and we're going to, you know, keep this up for as long as it takes. But again, we've had some rock star volunteers who have stepped up, who've been at every single clinic. So we're still encouraging folks to come forward if they so desire. I will admit we do have a little bit of a backlog right now. So if you contacted us recently, a lot of folks have submitted their paperwork, their background checks, et cetera, and we're still working through a lot of those. But right now, again, everyone who stepped up, we've been able to staff all of our clinics. We're getting to a point where we're still comfortable with the teams that we have. But if you do want to come forward, please do. Just know the need is not as urgent right now as it initially was.
Great. A couple of questions on that. Number one, you have two categories of volunteers. There's the riffraff like me that have no specific skills. And then there are people who have a medical background. Can you describe what the medical background is that you're looking for? And then for both categories of volunteers, how do they volunteer?
Yep, can do. So the medical volunteers, we're looking for folks with either active or inactive licenses to practice in the state of Washington. And that includes a pretty wide range of folks, everything from MDs to RNs. There are some folks who are allowed to administer vaccines that include, you know, EMTs, paramedics, veterinarians, dentists, things like that. So that information is available on the How to Volunteer section of our website. Again, an active or inactive license, but it needs to be within the state of Washington. For everyone else, the riffraff that Philip spoke of, those folks really any wide range of skills. So if you have skills on the phone or on the computer, we might be able to use you in our call center. We can also use help with traffic control. If you're more of a customer service oriented type person, we can use you as a greeter at one of the clinics. Or if you want to work behind the scenes, we can definitely use some help in logistics and setup. And if you're unsure about where you might specifically fit in, if it might be a good fit, do just reach out to us and give us a little bit of your background and kind of what you're looking for. And we're more than happy to work with you. I will say the one thing that we are looking for more than anything else is the ability to commit, especially for the, you know, the vaccinator and the medically trained positions. There is a lot of training. There is a lot of paperwork to make sure that you're properly vetted. And we jump through some of the bureaucratic hoops, all that kind of fun stuff. So once you get through that, we do want to see you out at a couple of clinics. So as long as you have a little bit of a time commitment, you can help out for a few Saturdays over a couple of weeks. We can talk about where specifically we might fit you in.
Thank you.
Great. Anything else for Willie or Dr. Locke?
Just a huge thanks to emergency management for helping both at the Jefferson Healthcare site, the Chimicum site, and these pop-ups. Just fantastic, and really for such a small department to be able to surge this way with volunteers is amazing. Mm-hmm. And really appreciate it. And again, you know, very much appreciate what an incredible way Jefferson Healthcare has stepped up, how a Tri-Area Pharmacy and a couple other pharmacies now, it sounds like being joined by Don's Pharmacy, are starting to do the vaccines, and just, you know, what great community service that is. So thank you so much.
Yeah, and I especially appreciate the, you know, going to meet people where they are and really try to meet the very specific needs of different sectors of our community. So important. I just feel so lucky. I was disturbed to learn a few weeks ago that my 80-year-old mother-in-law, a Black woman.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. Thank you for listening and for supporting your local community radio station. To make a donation to KPTZ, please visit kptz.org.
And this is KPTZ, Fort Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting. Again, a reminder, the recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. And again, thank you for listening.